know her well,
Sheriff?
Not in the personal sense, but she was a bar girl at the Boy Howdy Boku Good Times Lounge, just outside Tansong Nut Air Force Base, where I was sent as a Marine inspector. You were a police officer then, too?
Yes.
He thought about it some more. You think it is possible that Ho Ti received this photograph from her mother or another woman within the family and mistakenly believed that she was related to you? Right now it's all I've got to go on, and the only connection to Wyoming that I have.
I see.
Mr. Tuyen, I'm going to need you to look at some photographs of your granddaughter for purposes of recognition, see some identification that she was indeed your granddaughter, and then we can make arrangements with the Division of Criminal Investigation to have the body shipped back to California.
Yes, of course.
Were you planning on heading back any time soon?
He was still looking at the photo in the plastic bag, and possibly thinking of other things in other plastic bags. I had intended to leave today, but I didn't seem to have the energy once I'd gotten in my vehicle. I stuck my hand out for the black and white, but he misinterpreted and shook it. So I took the photograph back with my other hand.
That's perfectly understandable. I can appreciate it if you need some time alone. But if you'd rather look at those things this afternoon, you'll have to come up to my office in Durant.
I'm not sure if I will be up to that this afternoon, but perhaps I will go back and check into my room again and see how I feel later today.
He stood. That'll be fine. Tomorrow morning is just as good. You still have my card?
I do. He stopped at the door and looked back at us. And you have my granddaughter's belongings?
Yes.
I would like to pick up those things.
I'm sure we can release them as soon as we get all the information back from Cheyenne, and I get some documentation on you and your granddaughter.
I will see to it.
He still stood there, and I knew what was next.
I am reticent to ask again, but I understand you have arrested a man for the murder of Ho Ti.
I crossed my arms. We have a man who is being held under reasonable suspicion in connection with her death. However, there is not conclusive evidence against him. In the backlight of the glass-paned door, Tuyen's outline was dark and featureless.
This man was living under the highway?
I'm afraid so. I could see the outline of his chest rise and fall.
It is difficult to remember that things like this can happen, even here.
He turned the knob, pushed open the door, and was gone.
Jeez, boss.
Sazer Vittoria had followed me out the door to the playground, where I stood with my boot propped up on the jungle gym. I looked out at the flat grasslands leading to the Powder River. There was a low rise to the east of town, before the breaks of the northbound water crumpled the plains like an unmade bed. Everything was a dried-out watercolor, and it looked like if you touched anything, it would crumble and blow away. We needed rain.
What did you say?
He stood next to me, his hand wrapped around one of the bars for an instant. Then he yanked it away from the cooking metal. He blew on his hand, kind of rough on a guy who'd just lost his granddaughter.
He didn't find her that long ago.
Jesus.
He barely said it, but I still heard him. I was having a hard enough time thinking about the things I needed to think about without the weight of his judgment. Call up Jim Craft down in Natrona County and get him to go check out the Flying J, see what they say about the stolen card. He cleared his throat, adjusted his wraparound sunglasses, and stuffed his hands into his pockets.
All right.
And then asked DCI if there was anything in Ho Ti indicating drug use. The brim of my hat hung across my brow, so I pushed it back and continued to look at the horizon for clouds that weren't there. He stiffened a little.
Why?
Because Paquette was, and most likely if she was involved in prostitution, she was involved in drugs.
I took my boot off the rung and stood there looking at him. He was a handsome kid, and there wasn't any back down in him, especially with me, and that's why I liked him so much. I turned and started toward my truck.
You'd be amazed at what you'd do if you were desperate.
Khe San, Vietnam, 1968. The NVA had found the range of the helicopter pretty quickly, and the mortar fire was singing around us like Roman candles in the monsoon wet. I ducked against the bulkhead and forced air in and out of my lungs, unsure if the whistling I heard was my breath or the enemy rounds. I looked over and saw Henry disconnecting Baby San Quang Sung from the webbing and the cargo net in anticipation of the Indo-Chinese fire drill from the helicopter. He looked at me only once.
Run, and do not stop until you reach something.
The generators, along with the Willy Peets, or illumination rounds, from inside the wire, lit up the area with a blinding sideways glare that threw dramatic contrasting shadows on the wet, rain-slicked surface of everything, as if the situation needed it. We were coming in hot, and the big king bee followed the contours of the valley as we made the final approach, skimming in about 6 feet off the hard ground, and stalling our movement at the LZ with the gigantic circles of water imitating the interlocking revolution of the rotors. Everybody moved at once. Hollywood Huang gunned the engine with a roar as we piled off on one side, the two corpsmen following Henry and Baby San Quang Sung out of the helicopter's side door and into the pouring rain and incandescent night. I came out of a crouch and shot after the receding images of the running men. The two corpsmen had slanted right toward the burned-out hulk of an M-47 tank, and Henry and Baby San disappeared into a trench about 50 yards away. I felt like a buffalo chasing antelope. As my foot came off what pretended to be the landing strip, I felt the chopper begin its hurried ascent, like it was falling from the earth instead of rising. Huang had given us all the time he could and was now on his way out. I ran the first 20 or so yards from the helicopter when something pushed me to the red mud with a tremendous outburst of air and an immediate loss of oxygen, along with an explosion much louder than the rest. The impact of the overpressure forced my helmet onto my nose and pushed me forward, and I slid diagonally in the raw, scarred mud. I was pretty sure I was burning. It wasn't that I felt like I was on fire, but the smell was so close that it had to be me. I couldn't hear anything, just the sound of my breath and the coursing blood in my temples. When I moved, it was as if I were viewing myself in slow motion. Even my head pivoted like it was on some long boom. I forced myself to get up but fell to one side in the muck, and I half turned toward all the light, my eyes closed with the fury of it, but when I half opened one, I could see someone lying in the distance. The fire backlit the outline of a hand, and then an arm reached out into the night air. I stumbled up through the smoke and slanted sheets of rain. There was wreckage everywhere, and the acrid taste of the fire filled my throat and pushed itself back out from my body. I gagged, but staggered forward, looking for the arm that had reached out to me. I fell over smoking debris and could make out part of the helicopter's fuselage as the drops sizzled on the superheated metal. Hollywood Huang's uniform was singed, but still mostly powder blue. I reached down and grabbed him, fell back, but held on, still trying to get my ears to clear the shrieking. He didn't weigh much, so I carried him, slowly pulling him the distance toward the trench and wondering what had happened to everyone else. That's when I saw the other bodies. One of the corpsmen hadn't made it. For some reason, the majority of the explosion had blown to the left and had taken him with it. The rotors, the engine, or just the sheer ferocity of the blast had caught him, and he lay there in 3 pieces. The other was crawling through the burning oil and was screaming. At least I assumed he was screaming, since his mouth was open. I got to the man, picked him up by the front of his flak jacket, and leveraged him onto one of my muddy knees. I grabbed again and got a better hold of him as his face rolled up toward mine.
Don't leave me.
I lifted Quincy Morton from Detroit, Michigan, put Huang over my shoulder, and turned, starting toward the trench again. The smoke enveloped everything, and it was as if we disappeared. I slogged forward into the darkness. The heat pressed against my back like a steam iron, and the weight of the two bodies slowed me down to a crawl in the mud that collected under my combat boots. I remembered the blocking sleds at USC, and the grueling two-a-days under the California sun squared my shoulders, put my head down, and pulled. I had taken a good 7 steps when somebody ran into me. He bounced off and must have fallen to the ground, so I released the Swabo corpsman only for a second to try and help whoever had fallen, but the Swabo misinterpreted the movement and grabbed my arm just as I saw the barrel of the AK-47 rising up and into my face. It didn't matter. I didn't have my rifle. He fired, the cicada sound of the machine gun coming unwound as I fell with the whistling rush of the bullets flying beside me. I came down on him hard and could feel him trying to get the automatic loose from under me, but I'd yanked a hand free and could feel his throat. Everything was wet, and we slithered there against each other. He was kicking, but the weight of all three of us didn't allow for much movement. I tightened my grip on his larynx and felt the cartilage begin to give as his voice box collapsed and pressed into the air cavity of his esophagus. I couldn't hear anything since the explosion, but I could imagine that I could still hear the spittle. He must have gargled like a baby working itself up for a full-blooded scream. It never came. He wasn't moving and wasn't breathing, but I still wasn't sure if he was dead. I lay there on top of him, retching, coughing, and finally vomiting. I spit and cleared my mouth and felt for the two men who lay beside me, feeling the corpsman's hands grabbing my arm. I got to my knees and then my feet, picked them up again, and staggered forward into the smothering rain. I gathered momentum, realizing that if we stayed out there in the open for much longer, we were dead. The NVA had overrun the garrison, and were headed for the wire. We were only a few steps ahead of them. I could feel my boots digging into the goose-shit ground, and what adrenaline I had left propelled me as we blew through the swirls of the remaining smoke and mist-clogged night. I continued to push off with each stride, growing just a little bit longer, and with the mantra, "I will not die like this. I will not die like this. I will not die like this." Men rose up ahead, but I didn't have time to fight them all, so I just continued on, blasting forward and taking them with me. The biggest was at point and tried to shrug down like a running back looking for a hole in the line, but I was too much weight with the two bodies I carried, and took him as I lost my footing and carried us over the edge of a flat world. We fell. Then I could finally hear the weapons firing around me and the curse words, thankfully, in English. I opened my eyes but could only see the reddish rainwater that filtered between the stacks of soggy sandbags and Henry. He was cradling his brow with blood filtering through his fingers as he laughed and shook his head with that bitter secret survivor smile. He spoke out of the side of his mouth as he fired the CAR-16 over the lip of the trench, the flame from the 556's barrel extending from the black metal like the eyes of some deflated jack-o'-lantern. The blood was still seeping from his head where I had hit him when he looked at me.
"When I said run till you reach something, I did not mean me."
She tossed part of a crust to Dog, who was sitting in the hallway to my left. We watched as the beast took the baked dough and swallowed it in two bites. "Because it's your turn and there isn't anybody else." She didn't look satisfied with my answer, but she was relatively happy that I'd brought dinner before I headed back to the ranch to check on Katie. Vic sipped her Rainier beer and watched as the giant folded the last slice of his pizza, stuffing it into his mouth behind the impenetrable curtain of black hair, and chewed. He had eaten all of his own pie, and all but the one slice Vic had picked at and the three slices I devoured of another. He'd chugged the liter of pop that we'd provided and finally lay back on the bunk and covered his eyes with his arm. Vic studied him for a moment and then spoke. "So the one night I'm going to sleep in the jail, you're going home?" I didn't say anything. She watched me as I took a sip of my beer. "Sure you don't want to stick around?"
"One of us can't leave this room."
I glanced at the prisoner, now snoring softly. And under the circumstances, she shrugged. "This is the shittiest pizza I've ever eaten." I continued to watch the Indian.
He seemed to like it.
"He lives under the highway. I'm not so sure his culinary sensibilities are all that refined." I peeled the R on the label of my beer bottle with my thumbnail. "Sizer Vittoria thinks I'm a racist." "That's okay. I think you're a slave driver." She pushed her ball cap back. The hat was a sign that she was having a bad hair day, something that I had learned not to mention. "Why?" I was kind of hard on this 2 yen fellow today.
Really?
Yep. I looked at the glue strip where the label had peeled away. I don't know, maybe it is prejudice. He was in the Black Tigers and Strata. She stared at me.
And for those of us who weren't born until after the age of Aquarius, what the fuck does that mean?
Black Tigers were the South Vietnamese version of our special forces. And Strata was a program that dropped these guys behind enemy lines. There were, I think, about 100 of them, and about 1/3 never made it back.
So this guy's one bad motor scooter?
Could be. I took a deep breath. His English is good. Better than any Vietnamese speaker I've ever heard. It was silent too long, so I changed the subject. Anything from Quincy over the VA? She lowered her beer bottle and looked at me as I stood and gathered the detritus, setting the 2 empty pizza boxes and bottles on the counter.
He's on vacation in the garden spot of garden spots, Detroit. I won't be back until first thing tomorrow. I told them somebody would be by.
Did you ask them if they were missing a 7-foot Indian?
I did, but the twit I was talking to didn't really come forth with much.
You want to ride over to Sheridan with me tomorrow morning?
No.
She stood, considering me as I stopped in the doorway and then leaned back against the mini-fridge door.
Not after sleeping on the jail floor all night, alone.
I watched her as she approached me, the way the uniform hung in all the right places, a lush, hanging gardens of Babylon quality of her general physique.
It's the uniform, right?
No, it's not the uniform.
I mean, because it's okay. I mean, some guys are freaky and they like a woman in uniform. But you're not.
We were standing in the doorway just out of the giant's line of sight. And somehow the conversation we'd been meaning to have was even worse here.
Not what? Freaky.
No, I'm not. She was standing close, and my back was against the wall, in more ways than one. She put a hand out and touched my sleeve, running her fingers up my arm and feeling the embroidery of the sheriff's patch. Those eyes turned up to me. I could smell her, all of her, and started remembering that night in Philadelphia again. Look. Her face was about 8 inches from mine.
What?
I don't know if... In the dim light of the hall, her eyes shone, and I found myself studying the haloed glow.
What?
What we did that one time was out of context, and now we're back. She slowly went up on tiptoe, and her hand trailed to the back of my neck as she pulled, and the distance between our faces decreased.
What do you say we slip out of these uniforms and get out of context again?
I brought my hands up to the small of her back and felt her shiver like a colt. Contrary to popular belief, the best kisses don't start lip to lip. This one started at the scar at my collarbone, nibbled its way up the muscles at the side of my neck, and paused at my jaw. I was having trouble breathing when I heard her moan, and it sounded as if it were coming from somewhere else, somewhere east, and not so long ago. I turned my face to allow our lips to meet, but she'd frozen and had turned her head toward the holding cells. We both stood there breathing, and her voice caught.
I think the prisoner is waking up.
I nodded and watched as her arm and face slipped away. I caught her and pulled her in with one hand, placing the tip of my chin on top of her head and holding her there for just a moment, not talking. I felt her sigh and then loosened my grip.
I guess I better get back inside.
I watched as she moved the folding chair and sat in plain view of the Indian, who immediately quieted down. If it makes you feel any better, I was thinking about asking you out on a date. Her head rose, and the dark gold of her eyes again shone, the lengthy canine tooth exposed like an ivory warning flare.
A what?
I could feel my courage heading for the hills. That's what we used to call it back in the old days. Dating.
Really?
Yep. I'm pretty sure my face was taking on a little color, but I braved it through and went back to pick up the trash from the counter. What do they call it now? The half-smile smirk stalled there like a cat playing with a mouse as she looked up at me.
Sport fucking.
I lingered beside her for a moment and then glanced at the big Indian before heading out. It just seemed like our timing was never right. She waited till I was halfway down the hall before calling after me.
You sure you go? Me love you long time.
Chapter 8. I took Katie with me to make the 66-mile loop over to Sheridan after we'd worked out in the morning. We were just passing Lake DeSmet along I-90 with Dog seated between us. She had her sandals kicked off and her legs folded up on the seat the way she always did. I noticed she'd dressed for Michael's arrival later that day in a bright turquoise broomstick skirt and a black sequined cap-sleeved T-shirt. She was wearing a stylish straw cowboy hat with a leather strap adorned with conchos and lots of feathers on top of her auburn hair. Her earrings matched her skirt. Biker cowgirl haute couture. She glanced up at me and continued to pet Dog.
Don't make fun of my hat.
I haven't said a word.
You were thinking about it.
I set the cruise control and settled back in my seat. It's a very nice hat.
Don't.
I glanced at her.
What?
You are going to try and be funny.
She took a deep breath and looked out her window and back down the Piney Creek Valley. This is the point where, as a father, you're supposed to say something, the right thing. And I wondered what that might be. She was obviously nervous about Michael's arrival, and it was my duty to assuage some of the anxiety.
You look great.
Her head dropped, and I waited.
I'm wearing the hat because of the scar.
Oh, honey.
I just thought at first...
She was silent for a moment, but it wasn't because there was nothing to say.
My hair is too short. I haven't gotten enough sun.
You look great. Honest.
I passed an 18-wheel truck and steered back in our lane. It means a lot to you, this visit? She reached out and adjusted the air conditioning vent, then readjusted it back to the same position.
Yes.
There was something I'd been meaning to talk with her about, and this was the closest to an opening I'd gotten. I had decided that as a parent, I would adopt a relationship with my little red-headed, large-eyed daughter that was based on an unrelenting truth. And it had become the only language we both understood.
Well, this would be a good opportunity for the two of you to spend some time really getting to know each other, even if it's just a couple of days.
I was hoping it sounded better to her than it did to me.
What's that supposed to mean?
It hadn't. I just think it'll be a good visit. Before you had these roles, he was a police officer and you were a victim.
I glanced over and then quickly returned my eyes to the road.
It was a hospital, and then it's been phone calls. I just think this will be a good opportunity for the two of you to be in a more natural setting and really get to know each other.
That's the second time you've used the word really. Meaning, we don't know each other now?
That's not what I said.
Really?
It seemed to me her mind was rapidly getting better. I tried my last hope, the authoritarian, patrician voice of reason.
Katie, I don't want to talk about it.
We drove the next 20 minutes in silence, as I took the second Sheridan exit, turned off Main, and made the gradual ascent to the Veterans Administration. The VA had taken over Fort McKenzie, and it was in a gorgeous spot on a plateau just north of town, with vast, feathering cottonwoods and solid red brick buildings. We passed the unmanned guard shack and the rows of conifers stretching shadows across the pavement, and she decided to talk to me again.
So how come I never met this Quincy Morton guy?
He was before your time.
More stuff that happened before I was born? She glanced around as I wound my way through the fort-like buildings. So, you had a hard time after the war?
I thought about it. I don't know if I'd call it a hard time. It was a confusing time. And I was looking for some answers. Quincy wrote me and said he was transferring to Sheridan from Detroit. She watched me.
Did Mom help?
Yes, but she wasn't in Vietnam. And I think I needed somebody who had been.
What about Bear?
I shrugged. He wasn't around. I could feel those composed gray eyes on the side of my face.
It doesn't seem to have affected you.
I parked the Bullet under the shade of a tree and left the windows partially down for Dog. I thought of the contract I'd made with her. Well, it did. When we got out of the truck, I noticed she left the hat on her seat. The Sheridan Founding Fathers had lobbied for Fort McKenzie as protection against hostile Indians. The fact that there were only 23,133 Indians spread over an area roughly the size of Europe, that this count included men, women, and children, or that it was 1898 and the director of the U.S. Census Bureau had stated plainly that the frontier was dead, didn't appear much in the argument. Pretty cagey, those Sheridan politicians, realizing the economic advantages that accrued by having an army post nearby. The market for local goods, especially beef, would increase, and the fort would provide jobs for a burgeoning workforce. It would also supply young West Point cadets to whom the founding mothers could marry off their daughters. One can only imagine the looks on their faces when the first troops of the 10th Cavalry, Companies G and H, disembarked from the Sheridan trains and were Buffalo soldiers. Quincy Morton's office was not in the same location. In fact, nothing was. I hadn't been to the VA for a while, and it appeared that the place had gone through quite a growth spurt. It was good to see Quincy again, and when I described the big Indian in my jail, he definitely knew who he was. You realize I'm under no obligation to give you any information without the proper authorization? I am, and if it makes you uncomfortable, I can go over to Chuck Guilford and get the avalanche of paperwork sliding, but that's not going to help this man I've got sitting in my holding cell. I watched as Quincy twisted his fingers into his woolly beard, which was now curlicued with a gray that I didn't remember. It was easy to see how the Plains Indians had made the association between the soldiers' hair and the coats of the roaming herds. He adjusted his glasses, glanced at Katie, and then crossed to a large oak file cabinet and knelt down. I noticed the drawer he pulled out was the bottom one, W to Z. White Buffalo. Had to be. He pulled a thick file from the hanger and came back over, setting the folder on the edge of his desk. I noticed he didn't sit. I'm taking this lovely lady over to the day room in Ward 5. Which has mediocre coffee but a glass solarium with incredible views of the mountains. He hooked his elbow out to Katie, and she smiled and joined him at the door with her turquoise skirt twirling. He plucked an ID off the navy blazer on his coat rack. The file stays in my office, but I would expect you in 15 minutes. It's a voluntary lockdown ward, but just tell them you're with me, and they'll let you in. He shut the door. I pulled Quincy's chair closer to the desk and looked around the room. I guess I was avoiding the file. The therapist had a framed poster from the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody of the 10th Cavalry Buffalo Soldiers on the wall. A couple of unopened meals ready to eat on his bookshelf.